Okay, just going back to One Nation, and there was a poll out during the week. It was a compilation of about 3 months, but it shows that One Nation at a federal level is now leading all comers in Queensland, including the Labor Party, and they're strong everywhere else, 20%. Or better, above the Liberals, I think, everywhere else. We've got this, Alicia Drew wrote to us, and she says she's a huge fan of the show, and she loves how you, Tony, reflect the stories using polling and focus groups. And she writes about how you've said in the past that One Nation wants to blow up the whole system, or at least the One Nation supporters. That's part of their motivation. She says, where are the Greens in all of this? Why aren't they being more vocal and active around being the viable third option? Surely the fractures and the frustrations in the electorate are ripe for the picking. And it's a good question. I just wonder, is that because they're kind of accepted as one of the established parties and they might be feeling the same kind of pressures that the others are feeling?
One of the more glaring numbers I've seen in polling recently is that we ask, the favourability of various leaders and international leaders like Trump. When we ask about Larissa Waters, who's the leader of the Greens right now, amongst almost 50% of Greens voters, so they'd never heard the name. So they're just voting for the Greens for the brand. And I think, you know, she doesn't have much cut through at the moment. The Greens are just one popular leader away, some charismatic leader, who I think, you know, will pivot off that populist economic approach. So we're seeing the rise of populist economics on the right, One Nation, and Trump is a version of that, and Farage. But then I think, you know, there's also that emergence of left-wing populism as well. Mandani is a classic example of that. But he's a generational talent in terms of his oratory and his delivery and his presence. I mean, he's a very charismatic fellow, even if you don't like what he stands for, and I happen to be one of them. But if the Greens had someone of a quarter of Mandani's capacity, they would be absolutely cannibalising Labor's vote. Labor's vote would be down in the teens as well. Now, someone like Pocock in Australia is someone, he's not a Greens, obviously he's an independent, but he strikes me as that sort of independent, charismatic sort of leader who's a pretty good communicator, obviously getting better as time goes by. He's still very new. And so I think, you know, there is absolute potential for the Greens to lift their primary vote.
And when you mentioned Pocock, look, you go back to disgruntled Liberal voters that went over to the Teals, and the Liberal Party hasn't been the same since. The one person in the federal parliament who is having that impact on disgruntled, not so disgruntled, Labor voters that they'd walk away right now, but the disappointed Labor voters, Pocock, they talk about him all the time. And the potential for that guy, if he ever decided to make a bigger splash, I think is extraordinary.
In the super sample that we did for the Fin Review, which preceded the news poll won by a few days, so it was a sample of around 5,000 collected over just 1 month as opposed to a quarter. And what was really interesting there was we asked for people to recall which way they voted in the federal election last year and how they're voting now, so you can sort of read who's switched. The coalition have lost 33% of those people that were voting for them last time, which was the low 30s from memory. They've lost 33% of them to One Nation. Labor have lost 12% of their voters from the last election to One Nation. So this confirms what we already instinctively knew, which was One Nation have cannibalised the Liberal vote, the coalition vote. But they're also starting to eat into a bit of Labor territory. And in the South Australian election, the seat of Light, which was a very safe Labor seat, they only won by 600 votes over the One Nation candidate. So there's a precedence there. And the great danger, of course, is, you know, they've effectively created a permission structure for more voters to look at them. The other big movement that we saw in that super sample, and Barry, listeners might recall that late last year when we had a super sample, Gen X men, 25%, one in four Gen X men were voting for One Nation. That was their kind of base. Now 35% of Gen X men are voting One Nation. But there's also been, and boomers, there's also been a growth there as well. But concerningly, we're also seeing a growth in millennials to One Nation. So it's gone up 11 points from late last year to 26%. So one in four millennials are looking at One Nation. And of course, in Queensland, not only is One Nation the most popular party in Queensland federally, but they're also winning on a 2PP basis. So there's some frightening numbers emerge.
Yeah. Earlier they used the term One Nation curious.
Yep.
And that's important.
Yes.
It's an important point because obviously by that you mean they're curious but not necessarily committed.
Yeah, although I've got to say in all of our focus group research they seem very devoted. They don't seem like they're there for turning. The exception, as I mentioned before, is when you stimulate them with information about Pauline Hanson's support for Donald Trump, which makes them hesitate. But they are very devoted at the moment. Now, there's limitations with focus groups because it's like asking a married couple on their honeymoon, is this love forever? You know, well, of course it is. But, you know, things might work out differently over time. So at the moment, they're very much supporters of One Nation. And it is that burn the house down mentality. Like, you know, another polling number we've had just recently is when we ask about the competency of politicians, it's net negative across the country, most voters. It's about net minus 30. But when you isolate just the One Nation voters, it's net minus 77. And that is, there's many different components to the One Nation support right now, and populism is one of them, and a device to sort of protest against the two-party system, but at its core is just they just think they're hopeless. Both sides are hopeless.
Yeah, and I do take your point that Labor's looking over its shoulder at all of this as well, but immeasurably the Coalition has the bigger problem. We got this email from Ian that the Coalition is picking up, it's on this question whether the Coalition should pick up the grievance politics of One Nation, and he makes the point that if the Coalition convinces the electorate that immigration, net zero, is the problem, doesn't that just prove Pauline Hanson was right all along?
Yeah. Well, I think the problem the Coalition's got is that they can't critique their way to government, you know, just sort of merely sort of identifying problems with Albanese. You know, it creates a bit of a mood for change and despondency with Albanese's approach. And he's net minus 17, so, you know, he's not very popular at the moment, it's fair to say. But, you know, One Nation voters are looking for something bold and dramatic right now and evidence that politicians are listening. So I think if the Coalition thinks they can just critique their way in, you know, they're going to be very sadly mistaken.
Mm. Now, Matt Canavan's address to the National Press Club, he announced he's embarking on an economic revolution. It's tempting to say, I'll say it, they've only got 14 seats in the federal parliament. It's not a great base in which to launch a revolution. But having said that, the guy's got ideas. Let's hear them. Mm. Sounds exciting. What do you make of the revolution?
Well, of course, his pre-political career was at the Productivity Commission. So, you know, he's no idiot. He's got an economics degree. He's obviously going to have he talked about how the Hawke and Howard era of economic reform is dead, which is interesting. Next week, we've got a speech from Angus Taylor to the Menzies Research Centre, so I'm going to be looking at that very carefully to see if he's in lockstep with Canavan or if he's going back to that Howard Hawke era type reform messages around that. And meanwhile, you've got Andrew Hastie sort of, you know, bouncing ideas around as well, where, you know, again, that unorthodox approach of Hastie, where he's been more than happy to take a slap at Donald Trump. He's been very aggressive on One Nation. And also he's been talking about that self-sufficiency message for quite some time now, and he's copped a fair bit of criticism, especially from The Australian, which is interesting that he's prepared to take on, you know, the so-called base. Mm. So, yeah, it's going to be fascinating to watch.
But what does he actually mean by a revolution, though? Of course, and he talks about getting rid of net zero, yep, digging up more coal, slashing migration. It's all sort of looking inward, a sort of anti-globalisation, ignoring the inevitability and the sort of the reality of globalisation and how technologies now have no borders. Just as it unfolds, I can just see him running into some difficult questions around the reality of what he's talking about. And I can't see, with net zero failed at the last election, I can't see that coming back and getting a second life.
Oh, I think, you know, there's many different components to what went wrong at the last election, as when it was poorly executed campaign from Dutton's office. You know, the nuclear energy just gave him a bullseye for Paul Erickson and Dee Madigan to hit, which they did very effectively. But in terms of that sort of the economic orthodoxies, you know, one thing that's unmistakable in all research, not just in Australia, but we're seeing it in the UK and the United States, is, you know, globalisation first came for the blue-collar jobs. And let's be brutal, the white-collar class, the political media class didn't see it as a problem for them. They just saw cheaper cheaper tools at Bunnings and all these sort of benefits of globalization and rationalization. But now, of course, it's coming for white collar jobs. AI is a classic example there. You know, we've had about 5,000 announced redundancies just in Australia. WiseTech was one of them. And 2,000 jobs there, computer coding jobs. So what we're seeing right now is huge anxiety in the electorate about, you know, their financial security and future security. And I think Canavan does recognise that. Now, you know, it might produce very bad economic policy, but I think it's fair to say that the public have not bought into globalisation and you know, sort of economic rationalisation either.
Yeah, no, I get all of the points you've made about that and the anxieties in the community about jobs and AI and the rest of it. But on net zero, digging up more coal, I just think it's a demonstration yet again that the coalition still doesn't get the power of the climate change issue out there in the electorate, and I think it's been demonstrated now for 15 years.
That's lessening, though, at the moment, and I think this energy security debate we're having right now, I think it could go either way. Like, there are some people out there saying, well, this is an argument to move more to renewable energy, but then, of course, other people pointing out the reality, by the way, which is the economy runs on diesel. You know, there's no electric semi-trailers or electric, you know, school buses and so forth. There's about 800,000 of those.
Electric trains, a lot of electric trains.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, sort of that ain't much help to you if you're in regional Australia or in the outer suburbs where public transport access is pretty limited.
They just announced a whole bunch of new electric trains in New South Wales running down the south coast.
Yeah.
And they're in the central coast. They go out to the Blue Mountains.
Yep, but there's 21.5 million registered vehicles in Australia, whether it be scooters, bikes, buses, you know, cars, passenger cars and so forth, and only about 500,000 are electric. So, you know, I can see the debate going either way. It's highly contestable right now, but it would be a mistake. I've seen some publications produced recently where people are just declaring it, you know, the renewable energy debate has been won. I would not say that at the moment.
I just want to finish up with just a couple of comments on Ben Robert Smith, just to say this. Look, it's no longer a civil case now, it's a criminal case. And the allegations of, you know, 5 counts of murder, you've got to make the distinction as civil cases determined because of, on a balance of probabilities, the criminal test is beyond reasonable doubt. And now that we've moved into this second sphere and it is a criminal case, usually this is a society in Australia that respects the rule of law. You can have a debate around civil cases, really, to an extent. It's part of it's tolerated. But criminal cases, not so much. There's such a law of sub judice, say, for example. Mm. And it just surprises me that that so many sitting politicians, Pauline Hanson for one, but others, and ex-politicians are all weighing in. They're not declaring innocence. They're not saying that. But there's mitigation in everything that they say. That's kind of reducing the severity, explaining away possible scenarios and so on. I just don't know for how long this can go on before the authorities say, well, now, hang on, we now have a case, this is not acceptable, we just have to shut it down.
Yeah.
We saw it with the George Pell situation. We saw it on both sides, those who were wanting a conviction and those who were just supporting him, and now we could be seeing it all over again with this one.
And again, that man, Andrew Hastie, who was a witness in the civil trial.
He was.
Which I thought took a bit of guts. And I think I know a lot of journos thought it was quite gutsy of him to stand up and testify. And he's likely to be called as a witness for this trial.
Well, when people do express their support for Ben Robert Smith, of course, you can't ignore the 21, the 21 soldiers who did stand up against him in the civil case. But Andrew Hastie has mentioned that he might be potentially a witness in the criminal case. I can't see that. I think I can see the contribution that he can make in a civil case, but I'm not so sure, unless you were there at the time, that your evidence is all that valuable. Well, that's it for today. You can write to us at backtobackbarrys@theguardian.com. This podcast was made on the sovereign lands of the Wurundjeri people and the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples. It was produced by Daniel Simo. Video production, Burton Nguyen.
The executive producer is Hannah Parks.
I'm Barry Cassidy.
And I'm Tony Barry. And this is Back to Back Barry's, a Guardian Australia podcast.